These days, visual designers are getting more involved in the user experience design process, and for a very good reason. Developers, analysts, and clients want to help, but they often lack the creativity needed to fully imagine a system that is functional, usable, and beautiful. Finding a tool to assist you can be daunting. Most UX prototyping tools lock you into their world of scribbly lines, low-fidelity layouts, and tired UI widgets. Imagine a tool that gives you the freedom to fully express yourself, a tool that lets you go as low or high fidelity as you want. Imagine that you can use the design tools you already know. With InVision, your imagination becomes real. You design screens using our tool of choice and choices and connect them together with InVision for stunning results that look and feel just like the finished product. You can even share your prototype tools and your prototypes with our clients and get feedback instantly. A tool built for the way designers work? Imagine that. Check it out at InVisionApp.com.
Hey there, Mike.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Oh, you know, doing all right. We have Dave. From the myriad of places on again. TUAW, the unofficial Apple weblog, 11 Minutes podcast, sci-fi podcast, as well as his very own 52tiger.net. Welcome once again, Dave. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well.
That's good.
How are you guys?
Yeah,
good.
Doing okay. A little bit tripped out.
That seemed to have survived the weather warnings, which is always good.
Yes, yeah. At the end of the last podcast, we had some sirens going off in the background from my end. But all is fine here. Doesn't seem to be no reports of tornadoes, ripping apart the countryside yet. So, I wanted to have Dave back on, as I intimated at the end of the last podcast, because one of the many things that Dave and I have in common, I know, is our practice of Buddhism. And I'm very careful with how I always I put that, because Buddhism is... oftentimes can be a religion, and in many parts of the world and by many people here in this country, it is practiced as such. Mm-hmm. But it is very much simply a philosophy, and one that one can practice and subscribe to without necessarily treating it as the same sort of religion or faith that would be comparable to, say, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, etc. I wanted to talk a little bit about that, because certainly that is a big part of what informs my approach to simplicity and minimalism and the ideas that I like to coin enough, hence the name of this podcast. But I wanted to find out a little bit from Dave, kind of how it influences him and his practices and the things that he does. I guess that's the question, Dave.
Well, cool. I'm happy to talk about it. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So, how long have you been, because I know that you are an even more fully practicing Buddhist than I am, in that you attend Sangha, you participate.
Pat, sorry to stop here.
Yes.
You just said a term that I don't understand, and I want to be the person who says I don't know, because I'm not a Buddhist.
Okay.
What did you just say? Dave attends what? Sorry?
Yeah. Dave, would you like to describe?
Okay. I'll do my best. The word I think you said was Sangha, and I hope that's how you pronounce it, because that's the word I do, too. And basically, it can be roughly translated as like an association or assembly or community. Basically, your practice with a group of other Buddhists and, concentrating on teachings and basically like a formal time to practice.
Right. And sorry to interrupt, but
yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, no, no. No, certainly. And that's exactly the reason why I please do interrupt and ask those questions. I even want to further clarify that oftentimes, these gatherings take place at like a Zen center or, you know, sometimes it's as simple as someone's home. Generally, it's guided meditation to a certain extent, not guided in the sense that here I'm going to tell you what to meditate about, but guided in the sense that, there is formal time for meditation begins here and ends here, and then there's some structure to the gathering, much in the same way that a similar way that a church service would have a structure.
There's certainly a formalized sequence of events, we could say.
Okay.
And depending on the school of Buddhism you practice, that would differ. I practice Zen Buddhism, so I'm only familiar with how formal practice goes there. But yeah, that's right. It's basically a formal sequence of events that the group takes part in.
And generally there's a teacher or a priest, as it were, or priestess or monk that leads the practice, the sangha, right?
Yep, that's right.
And generally these things take place on regular times and regular days. And so one of the things that I find most interesting is that I don't really know if my approach to the things that I discuss on Minimal Mac and Enough and Mindfulness would be where they are and the way they are as far as what I believe in, if not for first having exposure to Buddhist and even more specifically Zen concept and belief and practice. Would you say that those things inform the way that you direct your life and your lifestyle?
Yeah, definitely. To answer your earlier question, I've been practicing for a little over a year, maybe a year and a half now. I first just started attending informal meditation just with the group, and maybe after three or four sessions there, I started going to formal meditation. And I'm very much a student. I want to preface everything I say by noting that I am very much a student, so forgive me if I make egregious errors.
Zen mind is beginner's mind, my friend.
That's right. Well, I'm the epicenter of beginner's mind. But basically, one of the things I've learned about the Zen school in particular is that, unlike other schools, specifically, let's say, Tibetan Buddhism, there's less emphasis on the Buddha's written words and studying and all that sort of thing, whereas Zen Buddhists believe that the enlightenment that you're trying to attain can be attained simply by doing, simply by practicing your meditation, whether you're sitting or walking or going about your day. And that's the part that's really affected my work and my life, as you asked. You'll hear the word practice a lot, and of course you've said it already a few times, and that refers to my efforts at becoming a more mindful person. I know that makes no sense, so let me get to it. A lot of times when you hear practice, it's it's towards attaining a goal. Like you'll practice your basketball skills so you can win the playoffs, or you'll practice your piano piece so you can ace the recital. And a lot of folks will ask, well, what exactly is a Buddhist practicing for? Is there an end result? And in my young experience, the practice is to simply extend your practice. So when you're sitting in meditation or when you're doing walking meditation, you're within yourself and you're aware of what's going on and you're nice and in the moment and you're doing all those things. And your practice is to, like I said, extend that out to when you're working. So I know that this is what's important now. This is what I'm working on. Or when I'm playing with my kids, my work is really important because here's a wonderful opportunity for me to play with these two people. And as I continue to practice, I get better at extending my practice, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And certainly one of the ways that, and I discussed this on, was it episode 14, where I discussed, you know, how I came about, basically came to Buddhist philosophy in an attempt to find non-medical solutions in dealing with my depression and my mania.
Otherwise, that was 14.
Otherwise known as bipolar disorder.
A great episode. If you're new to the show, I urge people to go and listen to that episode, so much so I'll mention it, so Pat, make sure he puts a link in the show notes.
Thank you.
It was very good, and as I say, it was important, I think, to a lot of the listeners.
So, for me, the practice is almost, it never ends. It's always going on. With everything I do, my approach to it is, in my greatest attempt, and I'm certainly not successful at this whatsoever, my greatest attempt to find, number one, the simplest, most friction-free way of going about getting something done.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, when doing that thing, focusing on doing that thing in the time that I'm doing it.
Sure.
Because for me, it is when I let my mind drift out and start running off on its own that it starts to have thoughts and ideas all its own that don't seem to be coming from me. And, you know, I mean, sometimes when I've joked before that sometimes when I describe my condition, it sounds a lot more like schizophrenia than it does bipolar disorder, but in some ways I almost treat it as such, but you know, certainly it is that idea of the reducing things to the least amount of steps and the least amount of choice and the least amount of things that would cause me undue stress, and more importantly, worry and suffering.
Yes,
and that the two go hand in hand. And
yes,
reminding myself that everything I approach has the potential to be a meditation on the present and the now, and that's what mindfulness is. I think mindfulness is a term that, you know, we throw around like, oh, everyone knows what mindfulness is, but a lot of people don't. And mindfulness is simply that, is the idea of not thinking about all the other things that you have to do in the future or that you should have done in the past or that you could be doing right then, you know, but focusing on what is right here, right now, and trying to be as aware of every sense that you have as possible. So... Mm-hmm. And being in tune with that, and that enlightenment, as you mentioned it earlier, is simply a state where you have achieved the you have achieved the really nearly impossible goal of being able to be in that state and remain in that state all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true, and I think you hit on something when you say how you still struggle with it. All the stuff I'm talking about now, you know, pay attention to what's going on and be in the moment and embrace what you're doing, is so easy to say, but it is so profoundly difficult to do, at least for me.
Oh my gosh, yeah, and same here.
It's it's a whole lot of work. And again, that's something that I'm practicing for. And you mentioned suffering too, which is another interesting term, because when you think, I don't know if you or your listeners know the Buddha story, but I'll give you the teeny tiny nutshell version. Basically, he was a pampered prince living in the life of luxury inside the palace, and he never really saw anything that happened outside the palace because his dad wanted him to grow up to be a terrific leader. So he made life inside the palace so wonderful that he would never want to leave. Well, one day he did sneak out with his chariot rider, actually on three separate days, and he saw three things. He saw an old person, he saw a sick person, and he saw a dead person. And that's when he was hit with the shocking realization that these things happen. Everyone gets sick, everyone gets old, everyone dies. And his motivation from that point on was to make that okay. It's going to happen to everyone. It's going to happen to his wife and his child that he loves. It's going to happen to him. And he's got to make that okay. And one of the, you know, the tenets is that there's suffering in the world, and the suffering can be identified, and there's something you can do about it. Now, the word suffering sort of gets, I don't know if it was interpreted completely correctly, because it's more dissatisfaction. Now, when you think about when something wonderful happens in your life, you're very happy about it, but eventually it'll go away, and you know the excitement of that fun will wear off, and it'll be gone, and then you'll be searching for the next thing, and so on. And that can, you know, apply to so many different things in our lives. And ultimately, the goal is to change the way you look at what's going on, like you mentioned, Pat, and you realize how amazing everything is. The fact that you and I and Mike are having a conversation right now, for, you know, three people on this planet, is the least likely thing that's ever happened. You live in Minnesota, you live in England, I'm here in Brewster, and I mean, imagine how many things had to line up for this to happen, starting back to our conception and our great-great-great-grandparents' conception and everything that happened before that. When you think about it, you realize how amazing it is that this is happening, and that spreads to how amazing everything is. Like, even when you're folding laundry, that's kind of dull, but you get to do that now, and you get to think about who grew the cotton that made this shirt, and who grew the dye, and what are their lives like, and what are their parents like, and what town do they live in, and who built the house, and you realize how we're all in it together, and how just incredible everything is. Just this is incredible, and that's how, at least in my experience, you can be really, really happy. Because you don't have to worry about the next thing, the next thing. The fact that I'm talking into a microphone in a comfortable chair and looking at your avatar in the BroShow avatar in a Skype window is amazing. Because someday I won't be able to do that, but now I can, and that's just great.
Yeah. And as amazing as it is, I think it also, the flip side of that is also how temporary it is, how fleeting it is, how small it is, how important it seems, yet insignificant it is. You know, that there is a duality and a balance there that we far too often take for granted, or fail to notice or fail to recognize, right? And that because of that, and that recognizing that, seeing all of that, and seeing in the broad scope of the word, not just, you know, with one's eyes and one's attention, but with one's vision and with one's scope, you quickly understand what you were saying, exactly how fantastical it is, right? While at the same time, ordinary and insignificant. And it's just, and I think that that's kind of where you know, well, my noodle gets blown out thinking about that, you know, when I reach that kind of thing. So, you know, I know that you have you know, mentioned and written about your struggle with ADD. You were only recently diagnosed and such. How does your practice in Buddhism and mindfulness and meditation, how does that affect that and help that?
Well, it's certainly a good tool. And again, I want to say off the bat that Buddhism isn't medicine or treatment for ADD.
Yep. So, nor are we medical professionals.
All right, please consult your mental health professional.
Yes.
I can only give my own anecdotal evidence. But, you know, as I said in the post I wrote, for the 40 years I've been alive, I've really struggled with what's typical of anyone who has ADD. And, I mean, in a nutshell, that's inability to focus on one thing for any given time, you know, exceeding distractibility. And then, you know, which leads to, you know, not getting things done in a proper time, disappointing whole lots of people, feeling badly about yourself, thinking that, you know, I'm the dummy, I'm the unreliable person, I'm all these, you know, wonderful things. And, you know, after, when I was, you know, in school in the 70s, kids, there was no such thing as ADD. You were just the antsy troublemaker. And for 40 years, I've struggled with how do I escape the effects of these symptoms? How can I become focused? How can I become reliable? How can I get things done in a timely fashion and with great results? And, you know, I've been pretty much unsuccessful for all this time. And at one point, I thought, well, what's something I can do to at least calm my monkey mind and stop from jumping about? And at the time, I was just found the Cape Cod Zen website and thought, what the heck, let's give this a whirl. So my motivations for getting into Buddhism were a little more selfish than I'd like to admit. But it has helped, especially now that I'm started formal treatment for my ADD. It's become a part of that more comprehensive plan. Like when I'll meditate before I begin my work day, not only as a part of my formal practice, but because it does help me focus and get ready for the work I've got to do for the day. And I'll meditate again at night before I go to bed for the same reasons. It helps my formal practice, and again, it helps me just unwind at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Dave, does your doctor have a view on the Buddhism side of it?
I don't know. I don't think we've ever discussed it, to tell you the truth. We don't typically
talk.
Bring up religion. Just make hand signals and that's about it.
So you just wave a prescription at him and he just gives
the
you
battery dead, honey. You need help. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, honestly, one thing, and this gets into the whole kind of mental health, I'll shoot off onto this topic, I'll draw it back quick, I promise. But basically, people who are not being treated for mental health issues don't understand, but there are two fields, and they very rarely meet, and usually you have one of each. There are psychiatrists and there are therapists. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor whose almost sole job is, at this point, for most psychiatrists, is medication management. They are pill prescribers. That's pretty much, they look at kind of the medical side of things from a brain operation standpoint. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, what you just described, Mike, you know, he shows up and he writes out a prescription and Dave goes home is pretty much, yep, that's the way it works. 'Cause that's their job. Right.
Yeah.
And that for the, what used to be the role of psychiatrists way back when, psychiatrists had a dual role that was mostly cognitive therapy, mm-hmm. and less medication management, just simply because the way back when there wasn't the kind of medication that we have now, and it's just exploded even more so thanks to pharmaceutical companies. So for that kind of talk therapy that we normally that we used to think of in psychiatry, that's actually therapy. And that's it's a completely different thing. And therapists generally, almost as a rule, do not have a license to dispense medicine.
Right. Yeah, there's a whole different person with whom I do the talking.
Right, exactly. So it is not necessarily surprising that, you know, that you wouldn't talk about things like your practice and your faith and the things that you're doing to kind of mitigate your condition with a psychiatrist, with the person who dispenses the medicine, that you would do that with a completely different person, and that you don't necessarily have to have that other different person, that's sure. a choice. And then even under some insurance plans, they don't even cover that different person. They only cover the psychiatry side of it, right?
Sure.
So, I digress. That was kind of a little bit of a rat hole, but I think it warranted explanation for those that didn't know that and don't understand. Coming back, and to wrap this up, are there any resources that you recommend? And I'll recommend some of my own, but I want to give you first chance for people who may be interested in finding out what Buddhism is all about, especially from a philosophical standpoint.
Yes, there are a few. One of the things I'll definitely recommend is PBS produced a documentary about a year ago on the story of the Buddha that was extremely well done. It tells the story beautifully. And there are a few, you know, poets and other, you know, practitioners who just describe their experience in the history of the Buddha, and it's really well done. I think you can find it on the PBS website. There's another great book called Buddhism for Beginners by, oh boy, I hesitate to pronounce this poor person's name.
So go for
I won't,
it.
But we'll put a link in the show notes.
Okay, all right.
I'll say on your behalf. it's called Buddhism for Beginners, and it is a great overview of really all the schools of Buddhism, which is nice. It says what they have in common and what they have that's different. Really, they're a single thread that, of course, goes through all the schools, and they branch off a little bit here and there. That's a great book. And the other one I'll do is there's a great famous Buddhist practitioner called Thich Nhat Hanh, I think is how you pronounce his name.
Mm-hmm.
He's extremely knowledgeable and skilled. He's written many, many books, and he runs a monastery in Paris called Plum Village, and you can find more at plumvillage.org. So those are really the three resources I would recommend for folks looking for initial information.
Yeah, and I'm going to recommend two more. The first is Buddhism Plain and Simple by Steve Hagen. Steve Hagen actually is fairly well-known Buddhist here in the U.S., and he's local here to my area in the Twin Cities.
Oh, cool.
He runs a Zen center here, I think it's, you know, a great book to start. Secondly, Mindfulness in Plain English, which is available for free, actually, as a free download at Urban Dharma. That's urbandharma.org.
Nice.
And it's a really good overview of meditation practice. And it's available as a free EPUB. So, it's really, really fantastic. I'll have links to all that stuff in the show notes, and I think we've pretty well covered it for now. But I really appreciate you talking about this, and I hope that having done so, going forward, people will have even a better sense, an even broader sense of where all of this yapping that I do about this stuff kind of is driven out of and comes from. Because because otherwise it just seems like a bunch of silliness. So, thanks a lot for being on once again, Dave. Really appreciate it. We'll have links to all of your places as well in the show notes.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm very happy to do it.
All right. And Mike, thanks for asking questions and being inquisitive and kind of being the ear of the listener. Always appreciated. All right. Thanks a lot, and I guess we will talk later. Cheers.
Bye. Cheers.